Crime and Forensics with Stephen David Lampley, your crime and forensics source from coast to coast.
Names like Dahmer, Bundy, Gacy, Wuornos conjure up images of heinous acts that one human can do to another. What causes one person to commit these acts? How do serial killers operate? How do they select their victims? Are there predisposing factors? Today on Crime and Forensics, we will attempt to answer these questions and others. Welcome to Crime and Forensics. I am your show host, Stephen David Lampley. Because of the information that I want to get out today, we're going to skip the trivia and the shout-out sections in order to give us more time to cover the material. Before we begin, however, let's do some background stuff. Let's talk about what is a serial killer. Well, that depends on who you listen to. It depends on who you ask and who you read. But basically, however, a serial killer is a person who commits at least 3 murders over a period of more than a month and has a cooling off period between the murders. Now, a serial killer is not the same as a spree killer. A spree killer is a person who kills 2 or more people in a short period of time in multiple locations, and there is a lack of a cooling off period. And that's what marks the difference between a serial killer and a spree killer, is the cooling off period. All right, now before we get into the information, let's also dispel a variety of false assumptions that a lot of people have regarding serial killers. The first misconception is that serial killers are all dysfunctional loners, and that is not true. In fact, most serial killers are not reclusive loners at all. Now, there are some who are. Some serial killers are right out in plain sight. John Wayne Gacy, for instance, was a prominent member of his community. He owned his own business, he was a clown at parties, and he was even a guest at the White House. Now, a second misconception regarding serial killers is that they are all white males. Again, not true. Now, there are white, black, Asian, Hispanic serial killers. Actually, in the United States, the overall serial killer population, and this comes from Radford University, the percentages are as follows. White, 51.7, black, 39.8, Hispanic, 6.7%, Asian, 0.9%, and Native American, 1.0%. Now, the third myth, the only motivation for serial killers is sex. False. There are various motivations and different reasons for serial killers to kill, and not just sex. And we will discuss motivation more in depth here shortly. Another myth is that all serial killers travel from state to state. Again, false. In fact, most serial killers have a particular area of operation. Most times a serial killer they'll commit their crimes within a certain comfort zone, an area they are familiar with and comfortable operating within. Now, sometimes serial killers may expand outside their comfort zone, but usually only after they're comfortable and their confidence has grown. Now, there's a misconception that once serial killers begin killing, they cannot stop. That is not true. One example of this is the BTK killer, Dennis Rader. Now, he killed his last victim in 1991 and did not kill again prior to being arrested in 2005. Another misconception is that all serial killers are either evil, geniuses, or profoundly insane. That is not true. Some serial killers, yes, are highly intelligent, but there are some who fall far below the average intelligence level, while the preponderance of serial killers are close to the societal norm in intelligence. In fact, the average IQ of known serial killers is 94.5. Now, most serial killers are not adjudicated as insane. Some, however, are psychopathic, psychotic, or possess other personality disorders. Some think that all serial killers are men. Again, not the case. While most are men, there are many cases of female serial killers. So what are serial killers if all those characteristics are false? Let's find out. All right, now depending on who you read and what study you go by, classifying serial killers can be as diverse as those doing the studies. In one study, serial killers are classified as organized, disorganized, and mixed. Another study classifies them according to their motives, while the symposium sponsored by the FBI on August 29th of 2005, a group of 135 of the world's leading experts from multi-disciplines determined that, quote, there is no generic template for a serial killer, unquote, and there are no special combinations of traits or characteristics shown to differentiate serial killers from other violent offenders, unquote. Additionally, they stated, there is no single identifiable cause or factor that leads to the development of a serial killer. Now, given these comments, the symposium attendees did list some common traits among serial killers. One of those traits is they have a leaning and propensity to violent behavior. A second trait is a disregard for local, state, and federal laws. 3, a disregard for societal morals and standards. 4, an uncaring regard for the rights of other individuals. 5, a void of remorse or guilt for their actions. 6, a need for control over their victims. And 7, a need for sensation seeking. Now, as related to the classification of serial killers into organized and disorganized, what then is a disorganized serial killer? Well, according to this classification, disorganized serial killers are spontaneous. They act without planning. Their victims are usually known to them, and there is little conversation with their victims prior to their murder. The crime scenes are usually sloppy, with the weapon and victim's body still on the scene. Now, because the attack of their victims is sudden, there is no need for any restraints to hold their victims, and there typically are no restraints found on the scene. As a person, a disorganized serial killer probably lives alone, lives and works near the crime scene. They have below average intelligence. They're usually an unskilled worker. Their father's work was also unstable. The disorganized serial killer usually had harsh discipline as a child and typically socially and sexually incompetent. After each murder, there is a significant behavioral change in the offender. Now, opposite the disorganized serial killer in the trichotomy is the organized serial killer. The organized serial killer plans the murder sometimes for a long, long time. Their victim is usually a stranger that they meet as they seek a particular type of victim. They're looking for somebody that meets what they're looking for, meets the fantasy, meets the object of their desire. The organized serial killer engages their prey in conversation but maintains control of that conversation. The crime scene of the organized serial killer typically reflects the control as well and usually has restraints on the scene that they use to hold their victim. An organized serial killer will typically remove the weapon and transport the body to another location after the murder. As a person, the organized serial killer usually has average to above average intelligence and is probably employed in a skilled trade or professional employment. The employment of the organized serial killer's father is typically stable. The organized serial killer probably had inconsistent discipline as a child and is both socially and sexually competent and is probably living with someone, possibly a partner or spouse. Often their need to murder is precipitated by situational stress. Now, unlike the disorganized serial killer, the organized serial killer probably has reliable transportation. All right, this is going to be a good spot for us to take a quick break, and we will come right back and get right back into this.
lied to, right? It's not if you're lied to, it's do you know when it happens? Studies show that the average person can only catch a lie about 54% of the time. Heck, you might as well just flip a coin. But studies also show that a person who has been properly trained in lie detection can detect lies about 90% of the time. A big difference. Stephen presented his How to Catch a Liar session at the 2018 Crime Con at the Gaylord Opryland Hotel and Convention Center, and had to be moved from the Washington Conference Room into the Presidential Ballroom due to the enormous number of registrations to hear his program. Even in the Presidential Ballroom, it was standing room only with 850 people seated. You can have this session brought to your company or organization. Go to StephenDavidLampley.com for more information.
Welcome back. Let's go ahead and skip over and discuss motives. Broadly, serial killer motives are categorized as 1. Power and control, 2. Mission-oriented, 3. Visionary, and 4. Hedonistic. Now, as a motive of the power and control serial killer, this serial killer wishes to exert their dominance over their victim. Often a power and control motivated serial killer was abused as a child, and this has left them with feelings of internal inadequacy and powerlessness in their adult lives. Now they have power as they commit their murders. It should be noted that it is very common that the power and control motivated serial killer often abuse their victims sexually, but this is not the primary focus, but is simply another avenue by which they exert control over their victim. The next, mission-motivated serial killers seek to perform some quote-unquote grand act, if you will, perhaps make the world a better place in their opinion. An example of a mission-oriented serial killer might be to kill all prostitutes, or perhaps all people from one religion or a lifestyle belief. They envision themselves as curing society in some way. The third motive type for serial killers is the visionary. Now, visionary serial killers are frequently psychotic. Now, being psychotic, they believe they are acting upon or acting under the direction from another power, such as a god or from Satan. However, the order to kill can also come from animals or inanimate objects as well. The fourth motivation type is that of hedonistic. Now, there are classifications of hedonistic motivated serial killers, and there are three of those. The first is profit. In this category, victims are frequently family members, and their motivation is to simply profit from the family member's death. Inheritance, life insurance, those are frequently the desires. The second type of hedonistic serial killer is that of a thrill. As a thrill killer, this serial killer seeks to induce pain and terror on his victims, and he experiences an adrenaline rush during the hunting and eventual killing of the victim. Now, thrill killers only kill for the excitement and the thrill. Typically, there is no sexual desire, and most thrill killers desire to commit the perfect crime, and most of them believe they will not get caught. The Zodiac killer, for instance, fits in this category. The third type of hedonistic motivated serial killer is that of a lust killer. As a lust killer, sex is the main purpose. Usually, to the degree that they inflict pain, mutilation, and torture relates to the degree of their sexual gratification. The weapons of choice of a lust killer are weapons that require them to be close to their victims, such as a knife. With a lust killer, they must increase the frequency of their kills or increase the degree of mutilation and pain or both. Now, Jeffrey Dahmer fits into this particular category. All right, what does a serial killer experience in the process of killing? All right, in 1988, psychologist Joel Norris identified 7 phases that serial killers experience. The first phase is what we call the aura phase. Now, during the aura phase, the serial killer begins to withdraw from reality. He or she, they'll begin to distance themselves from people and from interactions socially. Although distancing themselves, most people, even family and friends, may not notice this distancing. The serial killer is in a sort of despair state, and life generally has no meaning. Now, depending on the serial killer, this phase can last from a few seconds or for a number of months. It usually begins as a prolonged fantasy, and that fantasy may have itself been present for a number of years. The urges often involve violent and sadistic sexual acts. Now, after a period of time, the serial killer must act on these urges. The trolling phase is next, and it is during this phase that the serial killer attempts to find a victim. As we mentioned earlier, most serial killers act in an area in their comfort zone, and this is where the serial killer will attempt to locate their victim. While trolling for a victim, they will also scope out a location to commit the murder, and depending on the type of serial killer, a location to dump the body. Now, this can continue for several months until a suitable situation can be found. Now, once a potential victim is located, the third phase, the wooing phase, then begins. And this typically only is utilized by the organized serial killer, if you're looking into that type of categorization. Once a potential victim is located, the third phase, the wooing phase, then begins. Now, this phase is typically only utilized by the organized serial killer, if you're using that categorization of serial killer. As the name implies, it is in this phase that the serial killer attempts to gain the trust of the target. The organized serial killer typically has good interpersonal skills. Usually only the victims that they have gained the trust of will be the ones that they pick as their victims. Once the serial killer has the victim at the selected crime scene, the serial killer's facade erodes and the real person is revealed. Now, when that happens, it leads into the capture phase. In the capture phase, the serial killer now has control of the victim, and the victim cannot escape. This is a relished moment for the serial killer. Now, once the victim is subdued and unable to escape, the next phase begins, the murder phase. Now, depending on the desires of the serial killer, he may elect to kill his victim quickly or may decide to murder the victims slowly, inflicting heinous pain and torture on them over a period of time. There are instances where the serial killer will torture the victim to the brink of death, but allow them to live, then bring them back, and then repeat the pain and torturous acts all over again. Now, using the organized, disorganized, and mixed trichotomy of serial killer classification, a disorganized serial killer will typically kill their victim quickly, and it is probable that the victim will be depersonalized and have facial and other bodily mutilations. The disorganized killer, who wants sex from the victim, can be obtained after the victim is dead. The organized killer in this trichotomy usually enjoys inflicting pain and goes more slowly. Any sex from the victim is typically done prior to death of the victim. Now, after the organized killer has completed his pain and torture of the victim, he can then proceed to the kill. This leads to the totem phase. During this phase, the thrill and excitement of the kill is now gone. The victim's dead, and the serial killer snaps out of this fantasy land and falls into a depressive state. To help combat this depression, some serial killers will collect souvenirs from the victim, and these souvenirs can consist of a wide variety of things: jewelry, clothing, photos they take of the deceased victim, or even body parts of the victim. Now, these souvenirs are taken in hopes that the serial killer can relive the experience of the murder. The final phase is the depression phase. After the murder is complete, the serial killer can experience a significant depression and emotional dump. A serial killer who has killed because he needed to release pent-up feelings from an unhappy or abusive childhood finds that after the killing of the victim, these pent-up feelings still remain and the killing brought no permanent relief. Unfortunately, the fantasies will return and the serial killer will fall back into phase one, the aura phase, and begin the process all over again. Now, this cycle can continue over and over until the serial killer is caught or stops. In some instances, the serial killer becomes tired of the killing and realizing that the murders are not releasing the internal issues he harbors mentally, he may resort to suicide. Okay, I hope you were able to take something away from this episode. Feel free to share this show with your true crime friends. Coming up next is our Unsolved segment. Until next time.
Lied to, right? It's not if you're lied to, it's do you know when it happens? Studies show that the average person can only catch a lie about 54% of the time. Heck, you might as well just flip a coin. But studies also show that a person who has been properly trained in lie detection can detect lies about 90% of the time. A big difference. Stephen presented his How to Catch a Liar session at the 2018 Crime Con at the Gaylord Opryland Hotel and Convention Center and had to be moved from the Washington Conference Room into the Presidential Ballroom due to the enormous number of registrations to hear his program. Even in the Presidential Ballroom, it was standing room only with 850 people seated. You can have this session brought to your company or organization. Go to StephenDavidLampley.com for more information.
Fox Chase area of Philadelphia is approximately 10 miles northwest of the heart of downtown. In 1957, this area was a rural location consisting mostly of woods and farmland. Susquehanna Road was a half-mile country road that linked Pine Road to the west and Verree Road to the east. There were no houses on Susquehanna Road at that time. The trees that ran along the road did not extend but a few yards in any direction. Susquehanna Road is approximately 4 miles northeast of the Delaware River and the New Jersey state line. There was a misting rain that Monday with a slight breeze and the temperature was in the low 50s. A college student, Frederick Benoit, attending LaSalle, was walking through the tree line along the northwest corner of Susquehanna Road in an attempt to reach the Good Shepherd Home, a Catholic home for, quote, wayward girls. What he discovered, however, was not the sights he had hoped to see in the windows of the girls' home. Although a dumping ground for the locals, There was garbage and rusting appliances, but what he discovered changed his plans and he quickly left the area. Frederick came across a cardboard box lying on its side, a shipping box for a bassinet measuring approximately 19 inches by 18 inches in the opening and 35 inches deep, with the word fragile printed on the box. The top of the box was opened, and sticking out of the box was what he thought was a doll. Scared, Frederick did not go to the police, but he did, however, tell his priest, who instructed him to go to the police and report what he saw. He did this the next day. Patrol officer Elmer Palmer responded to the scene and walked the short dirt path to where the box was located. As he approached the box opening, he observed what appeared to be a young boy. One of the boy's shoulders was also partially out of the box. The remainder of the lifeless body was wrapped in a cheap and faded cotton flannel blanket cut into two unequal pieces, with a plaid design of diamonds and blocks, and colors of white, rust, green, and brown. The blanket had been repaired with poor quality cotton thread, apparently with a home sewing machine. The boy was dry, but his right hand and both feet were wrinkled as if the boy had been in water just before or sometime after his death. His arms were neatly folded across his abdomen. The boy's fingernails and toenails had been neatly trimmed. His eyes were slightly open, as if he was just waking from sleep. The young boy appeared to be around 4 to 6 years of age. He had blue eyes, medium brown hair that had been chopped off in chunks, and the clumps of hair clung to his body. He was fair-complected. The boy was 40 inches in length and weighed 30 pounds. It appeared as though his eyebrows had been styled as if a female would do hers. His lips were crusted with blood, and in his throat was a brownish substance, appearing that he may have vomited prior to his death. He possessed a full set of baby teeth. The boy was extremely malnourished and had not eaten in 2 to 3 days prior to his death. There were no vaccination scars, indicating he had never attended public school. Due to external conditions, it is unsure if the boy had been there for 2 days or 3 weeks. The boy was nude except for what cover was made by the blanket in which he was wrapped. During the investigation, it was discovered that the box was originally a box containing a new bassinet that was sold by the J.C. Penney Company. That particular bassinet was sold by the Upper Darby J.C. Penney store sometime between December 3, 1956 and February 16, 1957. It was one of 12 sold by that store at a price of $7.50. All bassinets were tracked back to their original owners, except for one. An expanded search of the area yielded a blue corduroy cap with a label of the Robbins Eagle Hat and Cap Company in Philadelphia. In speaking with the owner, Hannah Robbins, they learned that the cap was one of 12 caps that had been made from remnants. These caps were made prior to May of 1956. This cap, however, was made without a leather strap, and the purchaser, a blonde-haired male, returned to have the strap sewn on the cap. After the police detective showed Hannah the photo of the deceased boy's face, she told him that the male resembled the boy. Unfortunately, she had no record of the purchaser's address. Police canvassed neighborhoods and checked every orphanage and hospital in the area, and all children were accounted for. Philadelphia police gave out over 10,000 flyers that had the boy's picture on them. The Philadelphia Gas Company mailed out approximately 200,000 flyers to their customers. No response. The case went cold and the boy in the box was buried in a potter's field near the State Hospital in Philadelphia. The boy stayed buried until November 4, 1988, and he was exhumed and DNA was extracted for future use and potential comparisons of possible suspects. On November the 11th, 1988, the boy in the box was reburied in a donated coffin in Ivy Hill Cemetery. Yes, this case is old, very old, but we really need to solve this one. The boy in the box deserves it. Do you have any information about who this innocent young victim is or who could be so heinous to have committed such a callous act? If you do, please come forward. Contact the Philadelphia Police Department at area code 215-686-TIPS, 215-686-8477. Thank you.
You've been listening to Crime and Forensics with Stephen David Lampley, your crime and forensic source from coast to coast.